Boston Lutheran High School, would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students from across the state to come and hear an oral argument with us. And if they accept the invitation, we send them materials about the case. They may engage in some activities relating to the case. Come for oral argument. And after this second case is over, the students meet with the justice assigned to meet with the students that day. And there's a discussion of the procedures used in taking cases, hearing cases, writing opinions, and releasing opinions. Everyone is invited to the discussion. No discussion will be held on the substantive issues of either this case or the case we heard earlier today. But everyone's invited to come. If anyone would like a copy of the summary of this case, if you raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left is Justice Patience Rogensack. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Justice Gableman will be the justice who will meet with you after this case. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right is an empty chair. Justice David Prosser ordinarily sits there. He will not be participating in this case. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case, 2013 AP 1532, Ash Park LLC versus Alexander Bishop Limited. Arguing on behalf of Ash Park will be Attorney George Burnett. He will argue for 20 minutes. The intervener, which is Ash Investors, will argue 5. Michael Marquette, who represents Remax Select LLC, will argue 30 minutes, and then Attorney Burnett gets 5 minutes in rebuttal. Agreed? All right. Attorney Burnett, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm George Burnett. I represent Ash Park LLC. The question before the court is a very narrow one. It deals with the interpretation of two words in a real estate listing contract. Those words are enforceable contract. Ash Park indicates, as did the circuit court, that those words are ambiguous. They carry two meanings. The pertinent part of the contract here reads as follows. Quote, if the seller accepts an offer which creates an enforceable contract for the sale of all or part of the property, close quote, then a commission is owed. The term enforceable contract is not a defined term in the contract. The Court of Appeals held that the term was unambiguous. The circuit court held that the term had dual two meanings.
The circuit court said that one was the legal definition of enforceability, whether it was binding upon the parties and therefore adjudicable by a court, versus whether it was factually enforceable. Is that the distinction the circuit court made?
Yes.
And you want us to adopt that. You want us to adopt the factual enforceability. Is that true?
No. I say that the term has two meanings.
Okay.
And that the term...
What's the meaning you want us to adopt?
In this particular case, I think the term means actually capable of enforcing.
Really? And so you would make REMAX the guarantor of the purchaser's ability and willingness to go forward with the sale?
Not the guarantor, but I would make REMAX's commission dependent on which, on whether a sale actually occurs or whether the contract is actually enforceable.
So it's not enough that they find a purchaser who signs a contract to buy the property, and which the circuit court, when it presided over the hearings to enforce a specific performance, certainly was acting as if the circuit court found it enforceable. Why do you think that's wrong?
For three reasons. Reason number one is the rules of construction regarding a contract say when the contract is ambiguous, the realtor who supplied the contract suffers. That it is the realtor's responsibility to set forth a clear and unambiguous contract. So that's the legal reason. The practical reason is this. In this particular case, the realtor had one job. This was a single-party listing contract. He brought one buyer to the transaction, Alexander and Bishop. The buyer reneged through no fault of the seller's. That
is the buyer reneged because the anchor tenant dropped out.
And he didn't have the financial resources that he had.
Without an anchor tenant, it's going to be tough to build and run a mall.
He couldn't get a mall. Well, he didn't. The offer, as the original Ash Park decision points out.
I'm sorry, what?
As the original Ash Park decision points out, his obligation was not contingent on the buyer being able to build a mall. The obligation was contingent on him buying the property.
Sure.
The second reason is the one thing the realtor was obliged to do, he failed to do. And the third thing is this. When you interpret a contract like this, you do it according to the intentions of the party as construed by a reasonable, ordinary seller. What does the seller think he or she is getting into when he signs a real estate listing contract? In this particular case, one of the insights into what a seller thinks and does is how the real estate industry presents itself to the world. How do we discern that? We look at advertisements, for example. They set parties' expectations. What realtor advertises they will sell a particular piece of property, and the ad runs something like this. Let me be your realtor. I'm a successful realtor. I will procure for you a valid and binding offer, and then my job is done. The ads that realtors uniformly run say, let me be your realtor. I'm a successful realtor. I will sell your house.
How is what you're saying not asking us to adopt the definition of enforceable as factually enforceable?
I'm asking you to say that this word, as used, these words as used in this contract, has two meanings.
That gets you halfway, okay.
That makes the contract ambiguous. If the contract is ambiguous, it is construed against the realtor.
You want...
I want the court to find that of the two meanings, actually enforceable is the meaning that is to be applied to this contract.
Enforceable in fact, to use the terminology of the circuit court.
That's exactly right.
And you have to have a successful sale. That's what you say in this instance in order for the commission to be earned and paid.
In this instance, it would be a little more subtle than that. there's two ways the realtor could earn a commission. Mm-hmm. Number one, the sale actually is consummated. Number two, if the seller does something wrong, he finds a more lucrative buyer, changes his mind, he doesn't want to sell the mm-hmm. property, so that he frustrates the sale after accepting an offer, he would owe a commission. So under those two circumstances.
The seller's fault or the buyer's fault in that it's not consummated. In either one of those conditions, you think no commission is earned.
That's correct.
Okay.
Did RE/MAX provide Alexander and Bishop? I know it's a single-party listing contract, so it's a sale just to that purchaser. Who found Alexander Bishop? Did your client find it, or did RE/MAX bring that client?
RE/MAX brought that client to the transaction, and that's why my point is that they had one and only one thing to do, and that was bring the single party to the transaction to close it.
Okay, but they approached your client and said, we want you to give us a single party listing contract. We have this person that's very interested in buying your property, but it was not Ash Park that provided Alexander and Bishop's name.
Correct. It was okay. Not Ash Park.
Thank you.
Why doesn't the underlying...
The fact that there was ultimately a settlement here, and I understand a payment of, $1.5 million, does that alter this at all? Does this settlement and payment somewhat change the idea of enforceable contract to the extent that money was paid?
No, for three reasons. First of all, the settlement occurred after Alexander and Bishop hired a lawyer out of Oshkosh and presented a very credible threat of bankruptcy. Number two, $1.5 million was largely equal to the holding costs that Ash Park had, so it covered outstanding interest for the many years this litigation went on, legal fees, taxes, those kinds of things. The real estate listing contract excludes a commission on holding costs. And number three, there's nothing in the contract that says in the event that the property does not transfer, is not sold, Alexander and Bishop is nonetheless entitled to take a commission.
How could the court have decided the case the way it did in Ash Park versus Alexander and Bishop at 324 West 2nd 703 if this wasn't an enforceable contract?
That is the law of the case aspect of the Court of Appeals holding. The Court of Appeals held that this has already been decided because in order to get a remedy for specific performance, one must have an enforceable contract. The Court of Appeals interpreted that term to be synonymous with a valid and binding contract. It did not interpret that term to be synonymous with a contract that is actually capable of enforcement. The fallacy in the Court of Appeals decision is that the cases it cited used the term enforceable contract, but they used it in that first sense. They meant you may not obtain a remedy of specific performance if there is a legally deficient contract. Here we are talking about whether you may obtain a commission for a contract that the buyer has contumaciously refused to perform. So the law of the case doctrine doesn't apply for the simple reason that in neither the cases the Court of Appeals cited, nor in the underlying ruling by this court or by the Court of Appeals did they ever interpret this term, enforceable contract.
So you think enforceable can be one definition for purposes of the specific performance case and another for the listing contract?
Yeah, exactly. The the term has a dual meaning. If we look at it from a common, does that answer your question, Justice Ziegler?
I think it comes close.
If we look at it from a practical standpoint, what the Court of Appeals held here is that despite all the efforts of everyone involved, there was an enforceable contract. We had, in this underlying case, about 18 separate hearings. Ash Park sued, prevailed on summary judgment. The Alexander and Bishop transferred property. Ash Park sued again for a fraudulent conveyance. Ash Park sought contempt. Ash Park sought a receivership. And the Court of Appeals held that there was an enforceable contract despite the fact that for all that effort, no one could enforce it. That is the practical side of this case. How can there be an enforceable contract when neither the judiciary nor the parties can enforce it?
Well, they did enforce it. There is a ruling that that the buyer has to buy this property.
Right.
There's a judgment on that. There's a difference between getting a judgment and getting paid on the judgment. Right?
The Court of Appeals held.
Well, in real life, that's true. Right? You could get a judgment against me for several $1 million. I'm not suggesting you do.
So she's probably collectible.
But the question is whether it's collectible.
That's accurate.
If you get in a high enough amount of money over my monthly paycheck, you got a problem.
But we need to fall back to the question and remind ourselves that this is a contract to be read by ordinary people. Do ordinary people read the words enforceable contract and say, well, I have to pay the realtor if there is a valid and binding offer,
mm-hmm.
but that certainly wouldn't mean that I would have to pay the realtor, would mean that I'd have to pay the realtor in the event that the contract, the buyer doesn't perform.
Well, don't we also have to interpret the words in light of the purpose of the contract? And the purpose of the contract was to give the seller money, right? That was the whole purpose of the contract, to transfer title and give the seller money.
That's exactly right. The purpose of the contract is to sell the real estate, and ordinary reasonable buyers do not read contracts and conclude, well, enforcing a contract is different than enforcing a judgment for a contractual breach. People don't think that way. And these are contracts that are approved by the department simply because, solely because, as the court set forth in the Sunday case, to give sellers an opportunity to have a single and understandable contract to eliminate past abuses is what the court ruled on Sunday.
How does the Wauwatosa Realty Company case fit in?
Wauwatosa Realty, together with the Winston and three or four other cases that REMAX has cited, all deal with different contracts. They predate these approved forms. They don't use the word enforceable contract. Instead, it was the realtor's responsibility to procure a buyer who was ready, willing, and able.
Right. And that seemed to me, now this is a much shorter opinion in 1956 than we write now, but it seemed to me that they were working on very similar language to the fifth criteria or fifth possibility of what would happen here, and that was, it looked to me like the language procure, purchaser, ready, willing, and able to buy, this was residential property, and then it was an enforceable contract, and then the buyer arbitrarily refused to consummate the sale. So,
if I remember Wauwatosa Realty correctly, that was a case where shortly before closing, a judgment popped up. The seller was going to escrow enough funds to cover the judgment if it was valid, and the buyer walked away. If mm-hmm. I remember the case correctly, that's what happened. The court reversed the circuit court's determination and said, this is a ready, willing, and able buyer who signed an offer. The realtor has procured that buyer, and it is entitled to a commission. There are two points I would make on that. Number one, the point I just made, it doesn't interpret the term enforceable contract, which we're here about today, and the REMAX has disclaimed any right to collect a commission under that portion of the agreement. That's found at page 27 of REMAX's brief.
You know, Mr. Burke, were those your two points?
No.
Oh.
I have one, but you have a question, so I won't.
No, I don't. If you have two points, I want to hear the second, but then I want to ask you a question.
The reason that language is important is twofold. Not because it provides REMAX a second avenue to collect a commission, but because it gives us some insight into what the terms enforceable contract means. It's sort of a difficult argument to follow, but it goes like this. The contracts are construed in a way that they don't provide a surplusage of language, that language is not redundant. In that contract, the contract says you may collect a commission if you procure a buyer on the same terms, for the same price and under the same terms as the listing contract. Then you go later into the contract and it defines the term procure. And it says, well, you can procure a buyer by finding a ready, willing, and able buyer, just like the cases preceding, or you can procure a contract by presenting a valid and binding contract. When you read them together, it requires a valid and binding contract on the same terms as set forth in the listing contract. Now, what does this all mean? What it means is that this is surplus. If REMAX's position is right, and all it has to do is procure an enforceable contract, why would there be another passage in the agreement that says, well, if you procure a buyer who signs a valid and binding contract on the same terms as the listing contract, why would it say that? That's surplus, that's redundant, it can't mean that. If I had to, I'm smiling because Sister Agnes Marie, my seventh grade math teacher, would appreciate this wherever she is. If you think about it as a Venn diagram, you have a large circle that, according to REMAX's interpretation, is all enforceable contracts. And then inside that circle, you have a smaller circle that says valid and binding contracts on the same terms as a listing contract. A large circle inside a small circle, that's redundancy, that's surplus. That is the kind of interpretation that courts eschew.
No, not at all. I think the sister did an excellent job because whatever she did, it took.
If there's any lesson for the students in the courtroom, it's listen to your math teacher.
If she's in seventh grade.
I would like to talk about surplusage, so I'm glad you brought it up. I'm looking at the first page of the contract that your client signed here with REMAX, and I see the commission section, and you are obviously very well familiar with it. Commission, seller Seller shall pay broker's commission, which shall be earned if, during the term of this listing, 1. Seller sells or accepts an offer which creates an enforceable contract for the sale of all or any part of the property. And these are all put in the alternative, so it could be any of these, because the last of the five conditions is prefaced by the word or. And then I go down to condition 4. This is another way that the realtor can earn a commission. A transaction occurs which causes an effective change in ownership or control of all or any part of the property. So how does your interpretation not render a 4 surplusage?
The short answer to that is it could.
Okay. And then I move down to the section you were referring to earlier, number 5. I believe you were referring to number 5 when you were speaking earlier about what you alleged would be surplusage.
Right.
Yes. And I read it in its entirety. It says, a purchaser, this is the fifth condition under which the realtor may collect or be entitled to commission, a purchaser is procured for the property by broker, by seller, or by any other person at the price and on substantially the same terms set forth in this listing and in the standard provisions of the current form, even if seller does not accept this purchaser's offer. Now, if we're going to read that condition, we've got to read it all. We can't just drop off that last section.
First of all, to finish my answer to your first question, that I said it could be surplus, but it's broader. Subpart 4 is broader. A lease, for example, would trigger the owner payment of a commission. You list the contract.
Under 4 you're talking about?
Under 4. So it's not fully surplus,
okay.
Surplus, but it could be partially surplus.
Ownership or control, yes. So lease would be control.
And then with regard to subpart 5, what that does is it just protects the realtor in the event that he or she presents a full price offer and
the seller says, I've changed my mind.
Changed my mind.
No. So, well, how is that surplusage? Because I read the purpose the same as you do, to protect the realtor in the event the seller rejects a full price offer.
It becomes surplus when we go to lines 164 through 167.
One moment, please. Okay.
And that says a purchaser is procured when a valid and binding contract of sale is entered into between the seller and the purchaser. So we stop there.
I'm sorry, what line are you reading?
164.
Okay.
Purchaser is
procured
when a valid and binding contract of sale is entered into between the seller and the purchaser. And then we go back and we look at line 55 through line 57, which you just read, that says it's got to be a full price offer. And that's why we have a large circle with a small circle inside of it. That's pure surplus.
Okay, thank you.
I see my time is up.
Thank you.
Mr. Burnett, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Marquette?
No.
Pardon? I'm sorry, I've lost you. Nielsen. Right. Attorney Nielsen, you're going to argue on behalf of the intervener, Ash Investors. Thank you.
Well, perhaps I could just frame my argument as being responses to the questions that you've raised. I would frame the what my client would ask this court to do just slightly differently than the way the trial court did or the way Mr. Burnett did. I believe that this court should find that there is a judicial gloss attached to enforceable contract in the very rare circumstance that this case presents. When a purchaser signs a contract that is enforceable and an order has been issued for specific performance of the contract and the buyer has been ordered in contempt of court to close on that purchase and that buyer refuses, as Mr. Burnett put it, contumaciously to close despite the order holding it in contempt for its disobedience of the previous order of specific performance.
That makes this case a ticket for Oshkosh on Tuesday, in my view. It would have no precedential effect because you have so many facts listed in there. I just don't see that it would be an appellate decision. It would be a good trial court decision, maybe, but not an appellate decision.
Well, if I may, Justice, it would answer the specific question that is being posed to this court in this case.
That's right, and that's when I was kidding you about ticket for Oshkosh on Tuesday. That's kind of an inside joke up here. Are we writing appellate opinions, or are we deciding this case?
Well, I do understand, and yet this
does
happen.
Oh, I'm sorry. How do we know in this instance it was contemptuous conduct? Were they found in contempt?
Actually, this court said in its 2010 decision that, let me just read what the court said. You said in paragraph 77 of the 2010 decision that Alexander was simply unwilling to perform, not unable. And then in paragraph 78, the court said that its unwillingness to buy was the very definition of contempt. And it referred to the trial court's order holding Alexander in contempt.
Okay, so Judge Atkinson found them in contempt.
Yes.
And ordered the sale to occur.
Yes.
And the sale did not occur.
Yes.
So the natural consequence of willful disobedience to a lawful court order, a judge has many available remedies at his or her disposal to punish a party for willful disobedience of a lawful court order. What punishment did Judge Atkinson issue in this case?
He issued a contempt order, and what this buyer said in response, if I may, is, I am like Bartleby the Scrivener. I would rather not buy. And this case got all the way to this court almost 5 years ago, with this court issuing a very strong and important decision about what specific performance means and how it should be applied. The problem with this case presented today and your decision of 2010 is that the fundamental premise in getting specific performance is for a person to prove that the contract is an enforceable contract. I can't seek that remedy as the seller or the buyer unless I prove that enforceable contract. However, the chilling effect of the Court of Appeals decision in this case is this, and it's very important. If I represent a seller of property and I seek to enforce this contract against the buyer, and I get that order, but I can't make that buyer buy. Now, as the realtor will say today, I just proved the case against myself for the owing of a commission. But I do not have a buyer who will pay me money and close. And as I think the Chief Justice pointed out, getting a piece of paper and getting money at closing are two different things. If I can, go back to a couple of questions about Wauwatosa Realty and the enforceable contract provision. Our contracts, listing contracts, used to say broker gets paid if he or she produces a ready, willing, and able buyer. This court said in three different cases recently that that can be short-circuited if the seller signs an enforceable contract. In Wauwatosa versus Parr, the buyer was ready to close. The seller had signed the contract. The court said, you owe the commission because you signed the contract, Mr. Seller. It was the seller seeking to renege. Let me just find the other two cases. In Hercules versus Robidoux, the closing occurred. The buyer paid the money. The commission was paid. The seller was seeking to get the commission back because it turned out after the closing on the initial sale under land contract that the buyer might not have been really ready, willing, and able because they defaulted. But the commission had been paid, and the closing had occurred. in Kruger versus Wesner. The seller argued that his contract was unenforceable, and thus he sought not to have to pay the commission. The court said, contract's enforceable, you must pay the commission. In all of those cases, the seller was seeking to get out of the duty to pay a commission because the seller was seeking to renege on the contract. This court has never faced, since 1848, a case in which a buyer has contumaciously refused to close after it has been found obligated to close. The question here is not, as you decided in 2010, must that person pay the buyer buy the property? The question today is simply whether or not the commission has been earned by the broker if that buyer is told to buy and then he absolutely refuses and cannot be made to buy. And Justice Gableman, I think it was you who asked, well, is the broker then the guarantor of performance? Not at all. But today the broker seeks payment of a commission on a sale that never occurred. He seeks 6% on a piece of paper contract that never closed. My client bought the property 6 years later. 6% of zero is zero. But he seeks 6% of a very large contract that never closed because his buyer refused to close.
Like your co-counselor, like Mr. Burnett, I also had a very good math teacher who was also a sister, and so I do know that 0%, or that 6% of zero is zero. Now, I don't want to, you have the red light on, but I would hate to see, for your lack of time, to prohibit you from answering the question that I asked earlier, which is, what is the punishment that Judge Atkinson imposed as a result of his finding of contempt?
I have to answer honestly that I don't know. I wasn't involved in the case.
Was there punishment imposed?
There was an order. But
was there punishment imposed, Mr. Nielsen? Do you know, yes or no?
I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Now, isn't there some sort of middle ground? On the one hand, to ask the seller to pay almost $340,000 is much when it didn't close at $6.3 million, right? On the other hand, it doesn't seem fair to the broker that the broker gets nothing. The broker came in with a perfectly good contract, a perfectly good listing. The broker comes in with a perfectly good sale contract, right? You got a lot of litigation, and you got a court judgment saying, forcible contract, buyer, you gotta buy, right? But, you know, can't force the buyer to raise the money if the buyer doesn't have it. They never got to that stage. Really, what you got was a settlement. So the seller got $5 million? And Patrick Crooks asked Mr. Burnett, hey, in effect, what I heard, isn't there a way, well, shouldn't you put the 6% on the 1.5? Now, I don't know if I've gotten the right trend of thought, but it is a trend of thought. So in some way, shouldn't there be a way of getting both parties dissatisfied? Not 100% win for either one of them. And I, as I heard Mr. Burnett's answer, the seller here doesn't wind up with a free $1.5 million to go out and have a good time. That there were expenses involved here, and that's just not a free amount of money. So what is a fair, just, equitable way of dealing? Now, you see, the specific performance is an equity, equitable result, yeah. Right?
Yes.
It's discretionary and it's equitable. So, no way out? I mean, obviously, you guys have not been able to arbitrate it or mediate it or settle it. But for the court, it just, for me, it just seems as if you shouldn't hold either the seller fully liable for the commission or the commission be zero.
Chief Justice, if I may, first, the amount that was paid in settlement represented, I think, the exact number that the court had set as a punishment to compel the purchase of the property. And the court, the trial court set that number based on the carrying costs of the property that the seller had incurred. That did not represent the equivalent of a purchase price paid by anyone.
Right.
It represented the seller's actual costs in holding the property. And the judge did say, I am ordering this against you, Mr. Buyer, because you have refused to buy. Now buy the property, please. So I don't think that that number should represent the amount on which a commission would be based. It would have to be some lesser number than that. You would have to also consider the expenses that this seller incurred. In the other cases that this court has considered about whether commissions are owed, the seller has refused to do anything. In this case, the seller spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, I assume, in legal bills trying to get the buyer brought by the broker to buy.
Counselor, your major problem for your clients is if we agree with the Court of Appeals and then the broker's lien gets put back into effect and they foreclose on your property, right? Because
yes.
Then your client will essentially have to come up with the money. They may sue again back to Ash Park and try to collect it out of them, but essentially foreclosure of the broker's lien, if it comes back into existence, that's really the only skin your client's got in the game, right?
That's right.
Okay.
And that would be an in rem remedy, of course, that would apparently spring from a money judgment entered against a person who is not my client. I don't know how that springs from.
Well, if the broker's lien is put back in place, it lies against your real estate that your clients own. And if you have a broker's lien, I assume you can foreclose on it like you can on a mechanic's lien.
Yes. I could. I have refrained from talking about that issue because you didn't take the case on that issue.
Sure, sure.
There are a number of things about whether or not that lien was ever valid, of course.
But should the Court of Appeals be affirmed, then it goes back on this issue of the lien.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Now it's your turn, Mr. Marquette. Michael O. Marquette, representing RE/MAX.
May it please the court. My name is Michael O. Marquette. I'm a sole practitioner in Green Bay, and I represent RE/MAX Select Realtors. Mr. Fulfer, the agent involved, is here with us today. I've been working with RE/MAX since October of 2009 to help and assist them in acquiring their commission in this transaction. The reason we're here today is to determine whether or not the offer to purchase between Ash Park and Alexander and Bishop was an enforceable contract. If it was, then Ash Park owes RE/MAX the commission according to the written and signed contracts that are before the court today.
Now, you want us to interpret contract terms, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And do you agree that the purpose of this contract was to sell real estate, which would transfer title and provide the seller with money?
That was the purpose of the list. The purpose of the listing is to acquire a buyer.
Okay.
Someone who will come forward and make an offer on the terms that the seller is seeking.
Right. And
yes.
It's the listing contract that gives rise to the claim for dollars, correct?
Yes, that's the contract that causes the commission to be due.
All right. Thank you.
Counsel, my concern in this case is that this language that we are focusing on, which is part of the standard form WB3, lines 50 to 57, is the same language, I think, used in the standard form residential real estate listing contract.
I believe that's correct, yes.
And so the ramifications, unlike this case, where you had 18 hearings and it's been up and down the appellate level. Last case we had came out of a small town, I think, in Crawford County. So this case and how we interpret this language will apply to the most important transaction that most people have in their lives, the buying and selling of a house.
That's correct. Yep.
Communities large and small. So I want to put it in that context because this is the same language we're interpreting in theirs. Is it your position, and I'll look at line 51, if the seller accepts an offer which creates an enforceable contract for the sale or any part of the property. So you have someone in Crawford County who's going to be selling their house for, pick a price, $175,000. And they have this same listing contract, get some earnest money as they usually do, and let me pick a number, $3,000, $2,000 earnest money. And for some reason, although it's a valid contract, the buyer walks and is willing to give up the $2,000 or $3,000 earnest money. Is it your position that the realtor still gets the 6% commission on the $175,000?
Under the terms of these contracts as they're written, unless they're modified by the seller and the broker, then the answer to your question would be yes, absolutely. Yeah. And that is the majority view throughout the country.
Mm-hmm. So that person then has to pay the, when you say unless modified, my sense is most often, if there is a modification at all with regard to the commission, it deals with the amount of commission. That's where the give and take takes place, if at all, in a residential listing contract.
Perhaps.
Counselor, is this proposed sale that went amiss any different because it arose from a single-party contract where REMAX is the one that provided the proposed buyer than it would be were our request for commission to come from an exclusive listing contract and there was a contract that went awry, but it wasn't from a proposed buyer by REMAX?
No, ma'am, there would be no difference. And the reason why is because Ash Park did not have an obligation to accept whatever offer was put in front of them. We don't know before an offer to purchase is actually drafted and presented to the seller whether or not it's going to meet the terms of the listing contract. This was the listing contract, I believe, called for a $6.2 million sale. So if the buyer came in and said, I'll give you $500,000 for it, then I don't think that we have that problem.
Okay, and I'm not really talking about the terms of the contract. I'm talking about the wherewithal of the buyer. Is there any obligation when you're bringing a buyer forward to have a buyer that can financially perform?
Not in Wisconsin, no, ma'am. There is not. The broker does not guarantee performance.
Even on a single-party listing where the broker is the one that brings forward the potential buyer.
That is correct. And Mansfield versus Smith at 88 Wisconsin 2nd, 587, 1979 Supreme Court case, talks about whether or not a broker is responsible for guaranteeing the performance. Now, I do not know if that was a single-party listing or not in that case, but I can tell you that the underlying determination is this, and I'm quoting the Supreme Court, quote, if the employer, the seller, enters into a binding contract with the buyer, in this case Alexander and Bishop, he effect is saying to the broker, subquote, I accept the customer as a ready, able, and willing purchase of lands, and the case, as the case may be, you, Mr. Broker, have done what you agreed to do. I have accepted the services rendered by you, and you have earned your commission. And it doesn't matter whether or not the buyer subsequently defaults.
Was the buyer that defaulted in Mansfield or the seller?
I do not know. I do not know. But I do know that in Winston v. Minkin, the buyer had defaulted, and the court this court in 1974 stated, generally, I'm quoting now, generally it is stated that when a real estate broker procures a buyer and a valid and enforceable contract is entered into between them, such as we have here, the commission for procuring a buyer is earned, comma, even though the purchaser may later default. The courts are practically unanimous in holding that a broker employed to sell or exchange lands earns his commission, unless the contract of employment contains a stipulation to the contrary, when a customer and the employer, the seller and the buyer, enter into a valid and binding contract for the sale or the exchange of lands. And this court has already examined this case back in 2010. And this court has already found that this is a enforceable contract.
This case is almost full-service employment for lawyers, don't you think?
Well, it's not doing too bad for the judges either, Your Honor.
Except we get paid one way or the other. Mr. Marquette, if you are done responding to Justice Rogensack's question, I would like to ask you some questions.
Well, I just had one point that I wanted to make. At
please.
Paragraph 44 specifically.
Of which case are you in, though?
I'm speaking now of this court's decision in 2010.
That's right. Okay.
Your decision at paragraph 44, about halfway through, you state, quote, in that case, now referring back to the Henriksen versus Henriksen case earlier in the paragraph, which is at 143 Wisconsin 314, a 1910 case that was cited by Alexander and Bishop. In that case, there was no valid and enforceable contract to transfer land. Rather, the agreement at issue was an oral contract that did not satisfy the statute of frauds. Henriksen does not address the remedies available to a seller when the buyer breaches an enforceable contract for the sale of land. When the buyer breaches an enforceable contract for the sale of land, such as we have here in Ash Park and Alexander and Bishop in 2010. So this, throughout that entire decision, you worked and began your analysis as to whether or not summary judgment was an available judgment remedy from the precept that there was an enforceable contract. In fact, at paragraph 17, note 5, it states, at the Court of Appeals, Alexander and Bishop continued to assert that it did not breach the contract. The Court affirmed the Circuit Court's decision. Alexander and Bishop did not include the issue in its petition for review. At oral argument, Alexander and Bishop's counsel confirmed, for the purposes of this appeal before the Court, we do not contest that there has been a breach of this contract. You can't have a judgment remedy of specific performance, or any judgment remedy for that matter, and Ash Park had a number of remedies available to it. They just chose to select specific performance. They could have selected actual damages or liquidated damages. They chose specific performance. But you don't even get that far unless you have as a prerequisite a determination that the underlying contract is an enforceable contract.
But they also have continued to pursue the contempt motion in front of Judge Atkinson until its completion?
I didn't hear that, please.
Could Ash Park also have continued to pursue remedy enforcement of the contempt finding that Judge Atkinson found?
I suppose that they could have, and quite frankly, Your Honor, we didn't intervene in this case until it became quite evident that the parties were going to settle. REMAX was waiting in the wings, anxiously anticipating the final satisfaction of the judgment.
It seems to me,
by Alexander Bishop.
It seems to me that in order for a circuit court judge to actually enter any kind of sanction as a result of contempt, the circuit court must make a finding that it is a willful disobedience of a lawful court order. So I assume that there would have been significant questions of proof in regard to the buyer's actual ability to consummate this transaction.
I believe that that's probably the case, Your Honor.
My next question. Mr. Burnett argued, he began his argument, I think, with the idea that we are to Part of what renders this contract ambiguous, or the term enforceable contract ambiguous, is that we have to read it through the eyes, or interpret it as a ordinary seller would interpret it. Justice Bradley asked a hypothetical about the sale of a private residence, which certainly sort of infers someone not schooled in the finer details of real estate law necessarily. In your brief, you made not a lot of reference, but you made some reference that caught my eye to sophisticated parties. And I wonder if you can expand on whatever the record shows to indicate that Ash Park was a sophisticated party.
Well, Your Honor, the listing contract and the sale contract, the person that signed them on behalf of Ash Park is a person by the name of Terry Gerbers, who is a licensed practicing attorney. And on one of the addendums to the offer, he also discloses that he is a licensed real estate broker at the time. But as I mentioned in my brief, although we do have very sophisticated parties in this transaction by happenstance, the fundamental principles of law remain the same if Ash Parks was, as I described, Mr. Ashley Parks. Because contracts, if they're not ambiguous, then the courts, and they're not against public policy, the courts will look to the four corners of the contract and enforce those.
Well, one of the fundamental provisions of contract interpretation is, as Mr. Burnett noted earlier, to avoid interpreting in such a way as to create surplusage.
Yes.
And to that end, he referred me to compare two portions of the contract entered into by the parties, and specifically it would be a line 55, a purchaser is procured. Okay, and then it goes on to describe what happens then in regard to the commission. And then Mr. Burnett directed me to lines 164 to 167, the definition of procure. And as I understood it, his position was that that would be rendered surplusage if we interpreted the contract your way.
I believe that what that does is it's the contract essentially saying the same thing twice. An enforceable contract is a valid and binding contract. If it's neither valid nor binding, it certainly can't be enforceable. And quite frankly, even though we didn't make the claim in our brief, under paragraphs 55 and 164 through 167, RE/MAX did procure a buyer. The enforceable contract is a valid and binding contract. So however one chooses to phrase it, they did their job. They procured a buyer by acquiring. The purchaser is procured when a valid and binding contract for sale is entered into between the seller and the purchaser. We know that happened. There's no question of fact as to that.
Why isn't it ambiguous? Why is it, in your estimation, not an ambiguous phrase? Capable of at least the two definitions as described by Judge Atkinson.
I think the reason that it's not ambiguous and why Judge Atkinson made, unfortunately I have to say this in court, he made an error, I believe, is that he differentiated between what the law is and what everyone would have liked to have happened. Well, unfortunately, the reason we have courts is because what we like to happen doesn't always happen. The term enforceable contract is not at all ambiguous. And it's not necessary in this contract, in this listing contract, for there to be a sale to occur in order for the broker to earn its commission. It just simply is not in there.
And for that proposition, you point to what?
I point to the contract, Your Honor. It's simply not in there. As long as there's an enforceable contract, which has been found as clearly evidenced by the specific performance judgment, they've earned their commission. There's nothing that says that a sale must occur. And in fact, we know that because
that's the purpose of the agreement. The purpose of the agreement is to have a sale.
That is the goal of the parties, to have a sale, but the broker is not responsible if the buyer...
It doesn't matter whether he's... The whole reason they entered into a listing contract was not because they were good friends, or maybe they are good friends or were, I don't know, but the purpose was to have a sale of his property so the seller can get some money and the title would transfer to whomever.
Yes.
And that was the whole purpose of it. So I think when you interpret a term of a contract, I don't see how you can ignore the purpose of the contract.
And that purpose was initially effectuated because Alexander and Bishop and Ash Park did negotiate back and forth several times. And ultimately, Ash Park did a pretty good job because they got an extra $100,000 above the listing. So there was a good deal of negotiation between those parties. And there was no financing contingency in the $6.3 million
contract. I'm not saying the realtor didn't do a good job. I mean, I think he did do a good job. Why the buyer was not able to perform, I don't know. That's not the record that, you know, we are looking at here. And certainly the realtor, did what he said he was going to do. He provided a buyer. But we have to go back and look at enforceable contract. And for me, at least, I have to look at it and interpret it in line with what was the purpose of the contract out of which the request for a commission arises? Well, the purpose of the contract was to sell the property.
Yes, and the property was sold up until the point that the buyer breached by not showing up on December 14th, 2007 with the money.
When I say sell the property, I shouldn't make a shorthand because shorthands always get us into trouble, I think. The purpose of the contract was the seller wanted some dollars, and he was willing to transfer his property for dollars.
Yes.
And neither of those things happened. He didn't transfer his property, and he didn't get any dollars.
That's true. But payment of the commission is not contingent upon that event
occurring. Well, and that's what we're here arguing about today.
I
understand. You said your position very well.
Yes, thank you.
I want to return to the lens through which we are looking at this language. Justice Rogensack put with the lens the purpose of the contract.
Right.
And I want to return to the same language that appears in residential listings because that is much more common, I would guess, than what we have here, a WB3 one-party listing. In fact, it's what I call bread and butter. Happens every day in communities around the state. And if I were a seller of my home, I would look at this same language, verbatim, and say, is it an enforceable contract if it cannot be enforced? So from the lens of a ordinary person entering into a contract with this language, how do you expect a reasonable, and of course we'd be using, I suppose, the expectation of the parties and what's reasonable, but how can you address that? Is it an enforceable contract if it cannot be enforced?
Well, ma'am, I think we have to make the differentiation that the Court of Appeals talked about. And I know this gets into a legal argument, but at the end of the day, all of us are susceptible to all of the laws that are in those five books, and the student should take note of that you're expected to follow everything that's in there. And we're expected to follow all of the case law that exists. That's the rubric within which we conduct business in the marketplace. Okay? And so within that context, an enforceable contract means that exactly what it says it means in our state bar book. Contract law in Wisconsin at section 1.22. Enforceable contracts are those for which the law recognizes the party's rights and protects those rights by providing a remedy for breach, usually either some measure of damages or specific performance. And so if it's an enforceable contract, then that home seller, in the example you've determined, if the buyer does, as happened here, defaults for good reasons, bad reasons, or no reason at all.
The seller or buyer, who are you talking about?
I'm talking about if the seller breaches.
The buyer.
For correcting me. If the buyer were to breach, okay, the seller would have the options that we provide in our society. They could sue.
They could sue. Now, maybe they'd choose specific performance, or maybe they'd choose a money judgment, or maybe what they do is choose actual damages, which means I'm going to go out and find a different buyer. And if that buyer purchases for less than the price that you and I had, Mr. First Buyer, let's say the house is $160 that you described, and my second buyer is only at $150, I get my $150,000 from my second buyer, and then I can go back and sue for that $10,000.
You know what
those
they
are the
do,
remedies we give.
What they do is they keep the earnest money and then put it, and it's back on the market, and hopefully they can sell it because they're not going to go to court.
Perhaps not. And most of the time in the real world that you're discussing, brokers also don't ask for their commissions under those circumstances because they want to get that next buyer and because the amounts of money are relatively small. This is a unique case because of the amounts of money involved. The legal principles are sound, but the reason that we're all fighting is because, as we all know, we're looking at a commission of $376,000. Okay? As I mentioned in my brief, just because these arguments are not often made by brokers, and just because this law is not often referred to, doesn't mean that it isn't sound, that it isn't long-held Wisconsin law, and that this is not the procedure, the proper procedure, in Wisconsin. So for many good business reasons, brokers probably almost never go to mom and dad and say, well, you know, the people didn't buy your house, but I want my commission anyways, and oh, by the way, I still want to be able to sell the house to the next buyer. That may not happen. But the legal analysis here says that technically it could.
You know, I'm sorry, if you're done.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Marquette, a question occurred to me while I was reading the briefs and the record in this case. And when I read cases, it's sort of like reading a book for me. And you expect the plot to go along a certain line. And I get to the point where we're at the contempt hearing. And as a former trial court judge for 6 years, I've presided over my share of contempt hearings. Obviously, the four of us, the members of the bench who had been trial court judges, had a vested interest in making sure that our lawful orders were followed. And as far as I can tell, that process in front of Judge Atkinson, that contempt process, was truncated. It was ended because of the resolution that the parties in that action reached for the $1.5 million. Is that reading correct?
I believe that that's a fair reading of what took place.
Well, then, how do we know? How do we know that this sale, this contract, was not actually enforceable in fact? If enough evidence had been produced in front of Judge Atkinson to show that the purchaser had entered into or had moved around money in order to avoid having money to somehow committed a fraud on the seller, or did in fact have the money in a different account, then it seems to me we would know the answer to the question of whether this contract was actually enforceable in fact.
Your Honor, I would suggest that the actual analysis is not whether or not Alexander and Bishop ultimately satisfied a judgment or specific performance, because that's all post-determination of the enforceability of the contract.
Right, but I understand the legal issue. I appreciate that. There's been a lot of discussion here, and some of the questions have presumed the lack of enforceability of this contract in terms of in fact. And I just wanted to clarify that my understanding matched with the record, which is we don't really know that on the face of this record.
I don't think we do, no. I think I'd like to just real quickly go back and address the ambiguity argument that was originally made. And I think that when we look at this, the term that's in the listing contract, and it says enforceable contract, and I know that Judge Atkinson struggled with that term, and he came up with this new concept of a contract that's enforceable in fact, which is, I don't believe, a legal concept that currently exists, because contracts are enforceable at law, which he found that this one was. But again, the Court of Appeals found that the term enforceable contract is really not at all ambiguous at this juncture in our development of the law. And they stated that it was, in fact, a well-settled point. And again, when we look at the State Bar book that I cited to earlier and that I quoted from, that book cites back to treatises with no less gravitas than the ALI Restatement Second of Contracts at Section 8 and Arthur L. Corbin on Contracts at Section 1.8. Those are the two fundamental treatises that courts throughout the country look to when interpreting contract terms and what they mean. And so the term enforceable contract, I don't think, is really subject to an ambiguity argument. It's really very clear. And in this case, the facts of this case meet the standards almost exactly. I mean, we have a situation where Ash Park and Alexander and Bishop contracted for the sale and purchase of this land. Alexander and Bishop failed to perform that contract. They did not show up on December 14, 2007 with their $6.3 million. By failing to attend that closing, they were then in breach. Ash Park sued them for their breach. It prevailed at summary judgment at the Court of Appeals, where Alexander and Bishop tried to argue that the contract was not enforceable, and yet Ash Park was successful in arguing that the contract was enforceable, that they needed it to be enforced, they wanted it to be enforced, and they wanted their judgment. And they got their judgment, and this court affirmed that specific performance is a proper judgment remedy if a seller wants it in a real estate case. These facts, they meet the requirements of the case law and of these treatises exactly. And once you receive that judgment for specific performance, the enforceability of the contract is no longer subject to interpretation. That's already been done. After the fact, when you go to satisfy your judgment, whether it's a money judgment or a judgment for liquidated damages, or in this case, for specific performance, whether or not you're successful in collecting on that judgment, as Chief Justice Abrahamson alluded to earlier, having a judgment and collecting on it are two separate issues. But whether or not you're successful in collecting on the judgment has no bearing whatsoever on the predetermined, necessary prerequisite of finding an enforceable contract. It doesn't. If the defendant doesn't satisfy a judgment, we don't go back retroactively and say, well, it looks like you didn't have a deal to begin with. If that were the case, perhaps I might be able to get out of paying for my house. I have a mortgage on my house. The note is the debt. I owe that to the bank. If I fail to pay, they sue me for breach of that note, and I'm in default. I'm expected to then pay it. If I don't pay it, then they've got a remedy down the road of foreclosing after a period of time. But what if during that time, according to their argument, I say, look, I haven't got the money? Does that retroactively mean that we go back and say, well, it looks like the note was no good to begin with? Then I get a free house? No. No. Whether or not they were successful in satisfying the judgment, whether it was after the Court of Appeals said that they had an enforceable contract and that the judgment was good, or whether it was after this court said that specific performance was a proper remedy in the summer of 2010. Whether or not Alexander and Bishop satisfies that judgment does not affect retroactively the predetermination that the underlying contract which created that judgment, which was the basis for that judgment, is somehow now unenforceable. And that's what this listing contract calls for, an enforceable contract. And if they have that, which they do.
Attorney Marquette?
Yes, ma'am.
You ended on a high note, mm-hmm. and your red light is on. So we're going to ask if there are any other questions. Hearing none, thank you.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Mr. Burnett.
Thank you. Just a few points in rebuttal. I think Justice Gableman's recent question really hit the nail on the head. The frustrating part of this case is the vantage point from which my friend and colleague, Mr. Marquette, has addressed it, and frankly, the way the Court of Appeals has addressed it. The question both have addressed is a enforceable contract a valid and binding contract? No one disagrees with that. An enforceable contract is a valid and binding contract. The better question, the more pertinent question, is the one Justice Gableman asked, and that is, why is the circuit court wrong? Why is Judge Atkinson's interpretation that there is an enforceable contract can also be a contract that is actually enforceable in fact? What is unreasonable about that interpretation? Is it irrational? Because that's the standard on ambiguity that these contracts are looked at. Is Judge Atkinson's conclusion something no reasonable person can reach? And if so, why? That question's never been answered. And that is the fundamental question in this case. That is why I took the approach. I said, well, let's look at that. And I think I began my argument very shortly into questioning. I said, well, let's look at how the industry, the real estate industry, the realty industry presents itself to the public. They do not present themselves as professionals who are there to procure valid and binding offers. They are, as Justice Bradley and Justice Rokensack point out, there to sell real estate. That is what the public expects. That's what they portray. That is why, if we are going to look at this contract from the vantage point of a reasonable person, an ordinary person, what they expect, that's why it's ambiguous.
Yes, sir. Mr. Burnett, okay, assuming a majority of the court goes along with that and adopts an enforceable, in fact, standard, definition. How do we know in this case, given the settlement that occurred, and it seems to me that it's either I don't remember it or the record's a little hazy, but it's my impression that the contempt procedure was terminated as a result of the agreement that the parties reached for the payment of the $1.5 million.
What happened with the contempt proceeding is Judge Atkinson never reached a conclusion regarding what sanctions would be imposed. The parties settled the matter because there was, as I mentioned before, a very, very, very credible threat of bankruptcy, in which case this contract would have fallen by the wayside and Ash Park would have absorbed.
Well, if your clients were so satisfied that bankruptcy was, I think you said, a very, very real possibility, then how could the contract have been enforceable in fact?
It was enforceable. The term the enforceable contract means enforceable. In fact, and this contract was not because of the threat of bankruptcy.
Okay, I see your point, but my question remains. We don't have a judicial determination.
Well, actually,
Judge Atkinson ordered specific performance.
Yes, and he imposed an interest penalty, I'll call it, to incentivize the buyer
and that didn't work. And then when we came to the hearing about this particular contract, Judge Atkinson made some very clear findings about whether the contract was enforceable, in fact, or not. And I think, though, his dialogue is quoted at length in my brief.
RE/MAX was not a party to those discussions. Is that right? RE/MAX was not a party to those settlement discussions?
No, RE/MAX was not involved in those settlement discussions.
So nobody gave them notice of, hey, we can maybe get for you another $300,000 or something in addition to what we're going to get out of the settlement here for ourselves?
No, the Ash Park covered their holding costs, and I was the guy who did those settlement negotiations, and I hope I extracted the maximum amount.
You may have, and I'm not quarreling that there were holding costs. I guess what I'm looking at is I think RE/MAX had some costs, too, here. I mean, Ash Park is not the only one that had costs when this deal fell apart.
Yeah, I don't know what costs RE/MAX would have actually expended. That's not part of the record, and there isn't been any.
Were they not a party at the time of the settlement? They got to be a party at the Court of Appeals. They were not a party when you achieved this settlement?
My memory is that the settlement came, RE/MAX intervened either shortly before or shortly. Yeah, they moved to intervene January 12, 2011.
Did they object to the settlement?
I don't think they did, and in fairness to them, I don't think they were involved in that.
But did the court approve the settlement?
No. It was nothing other than executed order for dismissal. Justice Crooks, do you have a question? Or?
All right. Hearing no other questions, I want to thank you, Attorney Barnett, Attorney Marquette, and Attorney Nielsen, for your arguments in a case in which we're becoming quite familiar with the facts and the legal issues, but you're in a different case in terms of the commission. That ends our argument in 2013 AP 1532, Ash Park versus Alexander and Bishop. The court will be in recess until about 1:30. Court recess is for lunch, and Justice Gableman will be out shortly to talk with the students.